a word that describes God and a word that describes us as a people or what we're supposed to become. And that word was grit. We serve a gritty God. If you were here last week, I promised we would continue our talk about grit and what we're supposed to do about a particular topic. Last week, I set the story up about how I rode a pretty long bike ride and I wanted to quit a lot sooner than what I wanted, but I pressed on. I introduced, we use a verse, Genesis 28, verse 15, that I am with you and you will watch over me wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land and I will lead you until I have done what I have promised you. Last week we learned about Jacob and how God had big plans for Jacob. Jacob was not an impressive individual at that point in time. He had not earned any special merit, but rather he was riding the coattails of his daddy and his daddy's daddy. He was a privileged individual, and yet he was a deceiver. He was a kind of a shady character, but yet God had plans for him regardless, and all the world was blessed through Jacob, and which we see in that one little passage, which there's many, many passages that we could have turned to, we have a gritty God. In faith, we believe that Jacob's promise is also promised to us, that God's not going to leave us until he has done what he has promised to do through us as a people. I introduce you to the work of Angela Duckworth, in which in her work she writes this. There's a lot of misconception about grit, which is much more than just encouraging people to try harder or not to give up. It is also about helping people find their passion. Having grit does not mean never quitting. It means quitting responsibly. And it's not just about in the tough times. And sticking to the things which are truly dedicated to. She taught us that grit is power and passion and perseverance and sticking to long-term goals. About my background growing up, I don't think I've shared this with you or where I come from. I come from Indianapolis, from the west side. And in fact, if you're around Indianapolis, you're probably aware of Wayne Township. Most people outside of Indianapolis doesn't know. They mainly recognize our high school, which was Ben Davis High School. I graduated from there. There you can see in my corner of west side of Indianapolis, I had a unique upbringing. Next slide. This is actually, I got this from the school's website. This is actually the boundaries of which Wayne Township in which I grew up in. And there in that big yellow arrow, it's approximately where I grew up. I was born and left, went all through high school, living through the same house in the same neighborhood. It was a good upbringing. It's kind of a goofy looking map, isn't it? I wonder why they laid it out like that. I sure would like to know somebody who did. That big gaping hole at the top, that's actually the town of Speedway. Speedway has its own school system, its own police department, its own fire department. It's a city. It's a town within the city of Indianapolis. And so that explains that hole. But the big mug handle out there on the right side of the screen, that's unique. That's different. And I don't know why these demographics were laid out like this. I don't know what the history is. All I can tell you is that that's where people of color lived. That was, in a sense, if you define a ghetto simply as a collection of minorities that live in a particular area, this is where the people of color lived. And there was an intentional effort to bus in those students to integrate it with the rest of that map. When I lived there, it was predominantly white. I was told it was an intentional effort to integrate the schools. Now, I'm going to show you a picture and yearbook, all right? But before we do this, because I want you to pay attention to the content of what I'm saying, if I show you my classroom yearbook picture, you'll be looking for me. So let's just get it out of the way. All right, I'll show you a close-up of me. All right, there I am. 1989, 90, you'll notice the full head of hair. All right, the hair's over the ears, and if you look at the bottom of the neck, you'll see the merging of a mullet. All right, right there. Okay, now we got that awkwardness out of the way. Let's go to the next slide. This is my sixth grade class. We had a total of 23 students. There were 19 of us that were white. There were four students of color, and we had two white teachers. One was a student teacher and Mrs. Berry, which we loved and deeply respected. You'll see the picture to the left. That was my sixth grade basketball coach. You can see there that there's a total of 14 players. Nine of us were white. Four players were of color. One Hispanic. And we had Mr. Harper there on the left. He was our coach. He was also my fifth grade teacher too. And he was a person of color. And Mr. Harper was the very definition of cool. To a young mind, you couldn't get any more cooler than Mr. Harper. He had the swagger. He had the confidence. He was a good teacher. He knew how to handle the situation. And it was a good upbringing. This slide represents a time of innocence for me. Growing up, we in the history classes, obviously we heard about every year the Civil War and how the root cause of that war was the disagreement between slavery. Do states have the right to bear a slave or not? We heard about the peaceful efforts of Dr. Martin Luther King when we took time out and we watched the entire television series Roots, in which it dramatically played out what slavery was like. We were not blind to the events of the past. We were aware. We knew there was a difference. But I remember very specifically sitting in that integrated classroom thinking to myself about hearing about the hate and the bigotry and the division. I thought to myself, this is stupid. Things are going to be different when we get in charge, when we're adults. This doesn't make any sense. Literally, I had a best friend. We'd go to that mug handle there on the map, and we would go pick him up every weekend, and he'd spend time with us and our family. He was an adopted son of my parents. And my brother had the same thing, and my younger brother, same thing. We went to the exact same apartment in the projects, picked him up, came to our house. He came, they came to us. Integration was very much a part of our livelihood, and we were comfortable with this relationship. Now, looking at that slide, I was kind of taken back. I thought that there was more diversity. What is the numbers there? 19 to 4. For some reason, in my mind, I had it myself, it was much more diverse than that, but it wasn't. So just to clarify, I asked some of our team members here, I said, what was it like growing up here? And the youngest of our team, Lucy, she shot me a picture. Go ahead, next slide. She was smart. She shot a picture in which she's not in, so don't look for her. She probably knew full well I would probably blow her up and embarrass her, and she was smart for doing that. 100% of the people on that page back in 2009, white. She says that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Lucy, there's probably four people of color in her entire class, and they were all raised by white families. I want to show you the next slide, and we got to get this one out of the way too, because I really want you to pay attention to what I'm saying here, so let's get it out of the way. Let's fast forward to my story here to 1994, 1995, my junior year of high school. There I am. Notice that the hard part's kind of getting a little less developed. Hair's off my ears, and the mullet's definitely gone. All right, so we're seeing progress here. All right, next slide. The social backdrop growing up around 1990, 91 was when, before there was cell phones that captured videos, before there was Twitter and live Facebook feeds and we could capture stuff, there was the video caught of Los Angeles police officers that were being videotaped of Rodney King, who was clearly helpless and was tremendous amount of abuse was it caused on him. It caused a backlash. It caused young artists to make songs and rap songs about the unneeded justice and the need for justice within their time. And they were writing rap songs that probably accurately described what was going on. Problem was is that the white kids in Wayne Township and out in suburbia was growing to fear and disrespect the police and the authority in which they had no business of doing so. That was the backdrop of this event of the O.J. Simpson trial. ESPN put out a very lengthy documentary lately, and I watched the entire thing. It was kind of a blast from the past. There were things on that documentary. I couldn't believe what took place. And I remember in my integrated school, there was a distinction, and it was racial. If you were black, it was a good chance you assumed O.J. was innocent. And if you were white, there was a good chance that you assumed that he was guilty. October 3rd, 1995, I was sitting in physics class. And our teacher, he wanted us to call him Roy, stopped class. And together we watched the verdict of O.J. Simpson. The tension of racial division was felt in that room. And when the verdict was read of he was not guilty, you could at the same time hear a jubilant celebration that justice had just been performed, primarily from people of color, to very audible and sometimes profanity-laced shock and disbelief of what took place. How could he not have been found guilty? Race was at the center of that event. And I was just 17 years old and I knew it. And I guess it wasn't that precise moment, but that event kind of shifted my thought. My sixth grade innocence had shifted. This division of racism and social division in just 6 years went from, this ain't going to happen when I grow up, to, this is a complex issue and it's not going to be easy and it's probably not going to go away for a long time. Let's get today. Let's talk about today. Because our nation has had a difficult 30 days, particularly really difficult 2 weeks. Sunday, June 12th, a gay nightclub saw 49 people shot dead. Tuesday, July 5th, the day after we celebrate our independence as a nation, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, a video emerged of a fatal shooting of a black man. And then police reignited a contentious effort that surrounded police killing of an African American. The very next day, July 6th, during a traffic stop, a St. Anthony, Minnesota police officer shot an African-American because he was reaching for his wallet. The victim's girlfriend caught the shooting and streamed it live on Facebook. The very next day, July 7th, an estimated 800 people gathered in downtown Dallas, Texas to protest the two shootings. What started out as a peaceful protest resulted in 5 officers being killed and a gunman who was 25 years old, an Army veteran completing a tour in Afghanistan with no criminal record, was killed in a standoff with law enforcement. And the aftermath has been severe. Next slide or next picture. Reemerge is the leaders from the Black Lives Movement, Black Lives Matter movement, speak up. And they have their facts. And they have their stories, and they're trying to communicate a message that's kind of difficult to understand and comprehend or know what to deal with. What's a person to do? Of course, when you're attacked, you have a counter message, don't you? Next picture, Pam. The counter message of all lives matter is being expressed. Then there's another counter message. Next slide. Well, the blue lives matter too, in which somebody feels compelled that they have to share that police brutality cannot be tolerated, but policemen have to protect themselves too. What's a person to do? Next slide. Then you have social media. Oh, man. You got so many messages flying around on my news feeds. I can only imagine what yours look like. I still have friends from Indianapolis. I still have friends from church world and, you know, from Bible college and stuff. And just the diversity that's on the page of what to think and what to do. It's so confusing. I find it odd that some of the most destructive and the most worthless things that I saw on my Facebook feed wasn't people from the country in rural Indiana that I live at now, but rather some of the classmates that I went to school with, shocked at some of the stuff that was being posted. Of course, you read the comments. That's the worst thing you can do if you're trying to find out and make things out, you know, unless you're engaged with friends and family and you're trying to be positive. You just don't understand, and it gets ugly really fast. And the memes, oh my goodness, the memes, worthless. Simply state something, try to be funny. Sometimes you laugh, but then sometimes they just completely disrespectful and have absolutely no being published. It's not helpful. What's a person to do? Next slide. Then you got the facts. The facts get reported, don't they? And then what's difficult about the facts is that, of course, you're going to be attracted to the facts of the position that you currently want to present. But the pattern that I see is that you give it 12 or 24 hours, and the facts that you hold to and believe in are contradicted by another set of facts. And some of these facts are from genuine, really good sources, reputable scholarship, reputable reporters, and the facts come in, you make your case, and then somebody else comes in with a different set of facts, and you have absolutely no idea where you should stand or what position's right. You want to be informed, but there's so much information out there that contradicts each other. How can you make the decision on the facts when you're not even sure if the facts are real or trustworthy? Next slide. Let's talk about godly grit and the race. And but with the backdrop of this division and this confusing time that we find ourselves in, grit is the perseverance and passion for a long-term goal. And as a people who live in the way of Jesus, we need to have a firm understanding of what God requires of us. Without this awareness of God's expectation, we're going to dig our heels in, and with the chance that we're in opposition of what God is currently doing. In faith, we believe that God is faithful to the end. We believe that He will finish what He has started, and God's efforts will always trump over ours. And since His grit and determination is greater than ours, we need to pause and reflect to see if our own efforts are working with or against God. That's true of any subject in life, and particular of this issue that we're faced at hand. Here's the good news. Next slide, Pam. Division, racial division, is not new to us. It's a theme of humanity. It's an underlying current within all the Bible. We're going to review a passage from the prophet of Micah. Now, the prophet's role primarily within the life of God's people wasn't to predict the future. I think television evangelists has kind of adapted that role for us. When you hear a prophet, somebody supernaturally predicting the future on behalf of God. That's kind of what I thought, and I think some of us still think. But a prophet's role was primarily to say, hey, this is what God has said in the past, and to remind God's people, this is what we're supposed to be doing now in the future. Prophet, his name was Who Is Like Yahweh, God's official name. And he likely began his public ministry in the year 722 BC. That's when Samaria fell to the empire of Assyria. The backdrop was racial division and a lack of national identity. When the Assyrians came in, split the country, contributed to the split of the nation, two peoples kind of emerged. They were shipped off as slaves, and they came back less pure, not really the right type of Jew in which the people in the south lived in, and they were treated differently. That's the backdrop of the passage that we're about to read. So let's skip ahead. Let's go to Micah chapter 6, and we'll start with verse 1. Listen to what the Lord says. Stand up, plead my case before the mountains. Let the hills hear what you have to say. Hear, you mountains, the Lord's accusation. Listen, you everlasting foundations of the earth. For the Lord has a case against his people. He is lodging a charge against Israel. In verse 1, we see that Micah has a message. And it's not his own. It's from the Lord. He's not inserting his opinion, his belief, his upbringing, his political stance. He has a message, and that message is of God. And he has an accusation to make. He has a difficult truth to share to Israel. And it's not pretty. Now, I think it's important for us to realize that when we read a text, we need to put ourselves within the text so that we can kind of see it through our own eyes. And if we do that, I want you to resist the temptation that you are the prophet, that you're the one speaking the message against somebody. But rather, I want you to assume the position of Israel receiving a case against you. Verse 3. My people, God's people, what have I done to you? How have I burdened you? Answer me. I brought you out of Egypt and redeemed you to the land of from the slavery. I sent Moses to lead you, also Aaron and Miriam. God's trying to get personal there in that verse 3, isn't he? Would you please respond with me? How, I want you to think, what have I done to you to cause this rebellion from you? I want to have a conversation with you. Answer me. Have I put such a burden on you in which this rebellion is somehow called for? God reminds the people of what he's done. He's brought them out of slavery from Egypt. He has sent leaders to guide them out of that slavery, that oppression. Verse 5. My people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, plotted and what Balaam, son of Beor, answered. Remember your journey from Shittim to Gilgag, what you know of the righteous acts of the Lord. If you want to, when you go home and read Numbers 22 through 24. Also, it's referenced in Joshua chapter 24. Israel was wandering in the wilderness, and the king of Moab, named Balak, he was filled with fear because Israel was so great in numbers, he was afraid. And so he sent Balaam to go curse them, but instead, Balaam blessed. If you read the text, God tells him, you must not curse those people because they are blessed. Shittim to Gilgal. Israel was getting ready to cross the Jordan River. Miraculous. They walked across it as the Ark of the Covenant went out to the river. The waters parched, and there was the water collected itself downstream, and so that God's people crossed the Jordan River on dry ground. God says, you remember that? You remember what I've done for you? Consider, because what I've done, what have I done for you other than bless you and want you to prosper? Verse 6, with what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with a calf of a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with the thousands of rams? Will 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I offer my firstborn as a transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? in response to God's previous actions and in the past, God's trying to make a point here, and it's a sarcastic point. How can Israel make their relationship between them and God right again? Should it be an outward sacrifice? Give a calf a year old. That was expensive. It would be expensive today, but even more so back then. But it is doable. How about 1,000 rams? Well, that's just ridiculous. How about 10,000 rivers of olive oil? That's even more ridiculous. Should I offer my firstborn son, daughter? That's completely beyond ridiculous. God's setting them up. Is there any kind of outwardly act that you can do to make things right with me? And then we get to verse 8. God has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Rather than the ridiculous nature of some type of outward sacrifice, God says, this is my expectation of you. Act justly. Love mercy and walk humbly with me. If a person was going to print a t-shirt, that'd be a good t-shirt. If you're going to put a bumper sticker on your car, that would be a good bumper sticker. If you're going to put a meme on the internet, that would be a good one. If you're going to put something positive and productive on a Facebook news feed, a message like that sure would be beneficial. If a person is going to get a tattoo, that would be a good one to impress on their flesh forever. To be reminded that God's requirement of Israel to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. I think that's the best answer on how are we as a people supposed to react to all the world's junk that's going on, particularly within our nation, in the last 30 days. Act justly, love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. I want to introduce you to somebody. His name is Mike McGraw. Mike grew up Baptist, and somewhere during his faith, lost faith, and was an atheist for a short time. But through a series of events, he came back to faith, and that transition brought about a significant change within his belief and how he communicates. Says some things quite a bit I completely disagree with, but he says enough stuff that's beneficial and worthwhile for me to pay attention to. And he's written out 4 questions to avoid without being a jerk while telling the truth. I've got it in your bulletins there, and I want you to fill these out. And I want you to pay careful attention to these. In fact, you would be wise to meditate upon these for a long time, because I think your life has the potential to greatly improve if you listen to these questions. And it's going to help us to act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly a little better. Question number 1, to avoid being a jerk while telling the truth. Am I communicating honestly and without hostility? Now, the first one, we value our speech, don't we? And they're right thereof. We've got no problems communicating how we feel, just saying. Are we communicating it, though, without hostility? Uh-oh. My message will be more best received if I take the time to process my own feelings before speaking. You want to act humbly. You want to act justly and love mercy and walk humbly with God. We have to be aware that the difficult truth that within has emotions behind it, and we have to be guarded about that. Are we communicating with hostility? Question number two, to avoid being a jerk while telling a difficult truth. Am I speaking for someone or against something? There's a little bit difference there, isn't there? Are you speaking on behalf of somebody that needs to hear this, or something that probably you're trying to protect? It's good to work for the rights of others, but I don't want to oppose something for the sake of opposing it. You know, them kind of people, doesn't matter what you say, they're just going to oppose it regardless of what. It's not helpful. It's not beneficial. It's not bringing any conclusions to the situation. Are you speaking on behalf of someone or something? Question number three, to avoid out being a jerk while telling the truth. What will I get out of saying this? What am I going to get out of saying this? If I stand to gain emotionally, financially, or any other way by speaking an uncomfortable truth, I may to examine my motives carefully. Some people say things that are controversial to protect the way they think they're supposed to be. They're trying to protect something. They got that. They're digging their heels in. This is important to me. I'm going to say it regardless because I have something to get. Some people say things because they're going to get paid if you say the right things. That's why there's a difference between one news sources of facts and one news sources on the other facts that contradict each other, because it's their job to oppose each other. And they're getting something out of it. Question number four. And this one's really got me like thinking quite a bit about a lot of things. To avoid being a jerk while telling a difficult truth, is what I'm saying driven by social identity? If the truth I'm sharing is commonly held among the people who identify themselves with labels I use to identify myself, there's a real chance that these beliefs are driven by social identity. I may need to check my sources and reasoning before speaking up. It's simple. Sometimes we say things so that we can fit in. Sometimes we want to prove how smart we are in comparison to other people, so we say things so that we can earn the favor of people we're aspiring to become. I see it from every walk of life, every walk of politics. They're trying to fit in, and they're willing to say what they need to say in order to fit in. Please consider that list. Keep it with you for a long time. Because if you do not, your message that you're trying to communicate will not be received. Your message will not be on behalf of others. Your message that you're trying to communicate will be selfish. And the goal of your message will ultimately be to try just to fit in, which is really not that helpful. Now let's take the eyes of ourselves. Now let's consider this. What would happen if this church and every church took that list and asked itself of this? The church has a message. And that message will always be countercultural to what's popular in the world. It's a difficult truth. We've been given a message by God to say a difficult truth on behalf of others. But we need to guard ourselves, and when we dig in, to show some grit on how we're going to do this. Is this difficult message? Her message would be better received if we weren't so hostile. Her message would be ultimately about the well-being of others rather than for herself. Her message would be selfless versus selfish. And the church's goal would include everyone in the radical love of God and welcome all into the community of saints. Those are just good general questions to be asked. How are we supposed to act justly and love mercy and walk humbly to God in these hostile times? And I think you're going to be a better person for it. I've got two more things to say because I don't know if we'll have another opportunity to talk. And it's a difficult one, but I think it's beneficial. I want to talk 2 points about the phrase, Black Lives Matter. It'll be short. It's really difficult to understand, to comprehend how to react with a message like that. We're trying to collect the facts, we're trying to form our own decisions, we get attacked. I want to show you that map again, Pam. Next one. On a map, it looks like I'm really close, grew up really close to the black neighborhoods and the ghettos. See that little distance between that arrow and that big white spot on there? Not very far. I cannot begin to tell you, it might as well have been a different universe. I was close, but it was different. The way people thought, dressed, acted, talked, parented, there was a fundamental difference between the issues that took place in their neighborhood versus the issue that took place in my dead-end street, full of peace and just a safe place to live. I was that close, but it was a difference, a world of difference away. When dealing with the difficult phrase of Black Lives Matter, I want you to consider this principle. In the context in which we live, up here in Indiana, in White County, we can only understand the black experience from far away. But it will always be out of reach to truly understand. There's simply no way that we can fully understand what they're trying to communicate. If we can tell ourselves that, then we can take a deep breath and pause when we feel like you're getting attacked. Principle number 2. The further away we are from a problem, the simpler it looks. Diversity, it's never within our reach. It's always out of reach where we live. We can never understand it. And so we're so far away, it's simple for us to come up with simple solutions. You just need to behave. You just need to follow the law. It takes a very complex situation and it simplifies it, which is to the point in which it's somewhat disrespectful, misleading, and enough prevents us from gathering the truth. Oh, just look at the facts. What facts are we looking at? Whose facts are we looking at? Whose can we trust? This past week, in my internet world, I've listened to a lot of voices about this subject. Things people say, like, how do you come to this conclusion? Okay, I'm buying into this. There's an internal struggle within and how to react with this. But I think within these two principles of knowing that true diversity within this community is always out of reach. And the fact is that the further away we are from the problems, the simpler the answers look. I think we can act a little more justly. I think we can love mercy a little bit better. And we can walk more humbly with God and with people. I want to end with a clip. Pam, did the browser refresh itself? Can we play the video or do I need to play the audio? What a lot of churches did last week was they scrapped the sermon and their ideas and they invited their friends of people of color into their communities to speak about what just happened the week before. My first reaction was, okay, this is kind of hokey. All right, so yeah, it showed up there. go ahead and expand it. Yep. And basically, we're about 50 minutes into a talk in which they asked two people of color to come in who they were familiar with and just talk about the issues at hand. I thought it was kind of hokey at first. I'm like, all right, all this room full of white people are going to walk away thinking, okay, now we understand it because we listened to two black guys talk for probably a total of 20 minutes each. But when, you know, the sarcasm and the critical spirit left, you know, it was a good talk. It's online. I'll probably post it on my news feed if you want to on Facebook, and you can check it out yourself. It's beneficial. And Annie Stanley, this is down in the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia, had a good point to share. And simply, I want you to consider what he said. I know there's a lot of, we're just jumping right in, but I think there's enough meat on this bone for us to consider. Go ahead, Pam. Hit play.
Prejudice and racism are almost impossible to see in the mirror because it's hidden in our hearts and it camouflages itself. You know, we try to see it in the mirror, but what we see is, oh, that's just my culture. We try to see it in the mirror and we say, oh, that's just my taste. Or that's just the way I was raised. That's just my upbringing. Those are just my values. And so here's what I want to ask you to do as we wrap up today. Would you ask God to do for you what he did for Peter? Would you ask God to show you? To show you? Would you say, God, okay, I think I'm good with this. I think I'm free and clear. Or you may be on the extreme and say, you know what? If you'd experienced what I'd experienced, if you'd seen what I'd seen, if what happened to my father happened to your father, if you'd seen, but would you, even regardless of your experience, would you at least have the courage to say, God, show me. Help me to spot it and despise it the way that you do.
Yeah.
Help me to despise it and to stop defending it. And give me the courage to eradicate it from my heart rather than keep telling myself that same story over and over and over that justifies it in my heart. We could all find evidence to justify prejudice and racism if we look around long enough. The thing that allowed the church to impact the world was a group of people that had every justification in the world decided to put those aside for the sake of something more important. And that was unity around a message that had the potential to change the world. And the reason, and you guys said it, the reason the church has to be at the epicenter of this discussion and at the epicenter of this movement is this. Only in the church are we taught that I'm looking at someone who is made in the image of God. That you are made in the image of God. And you cannot mistreat my children and get along with me. And I cannot mistreat you and get along with my Father in heaven. That is the message of the New Testament. And that is the message of the cross. And that trumps my experience. And it trumps your experience. And it trumps what I've experienced, what my family has experienced, what I've heard, and all of the things that break my heart in terms of what's going on in culture. We have the message. We have the leverage. And if you're a Christian, what you don't have is an excuse. We're going to end with a song.
I hope today we don't have answers, but I think that's okay. We got to start somewhere. And hopefully today we saw the word just and implies justice, and we can realize this is a part of our call and our mission. And hopefully we can act justly and love mercy and walk more humbly today because of what we heard today. Could you please stand with me and together we'll sing the song Changed. We've been called to be a blessing to others. We've been changing our hearts to bring about a good word to a broken people.